This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, whither Afghanistan? What is the status of what has become the longest war in American history? Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. U.S. President Donald Trump made no mention of Afghanistan in his inaugural address, nor in his most recent address to a joint session of Congress. And yet, after more than a decade and a half of war, General John Nicholson, commander of U.S. and coalition forces in Afghanistan, told the Senate Armed Services Committee in February that the war in Afghanistan is in a stalemate. Republican Senators Lindsey Graham and John McCain have urged the administration to treat Afghanistan with the same urgency as the fight against the so-called Islamic State. According to a U.S. Inspector General report, the Afghan government controls or influences just 57% of the country's districts, down from 72% just over a year ago. According to analyst Andrew Basevich, despite appropriating over three-quarters of $1 trillion on Afghanistan since 2001, Afghan security forces continue to be plagued by the problem of inflated roles, with local commanders pocketing American-supplied funds to pay for non-existent soldiers. Though Washington has spent billions of dollars to battle narcotics in Afghanistan, opium production there has reached an all-time high. And to make matters worse, an offshoot of the so-called Islamic State, also known as ISIL, based near the Afghan-Pakistan border, is expanding into new areas, recruiting fighters and widening the reach of attacks in the region. Well, with us to analyze the forgotten war in Afghanistan, the pros and cons of sending more troops, and the emerging presence of ISIS or ISIL are two distinguished regional analysts. Michael Kugelman is Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center, and that's a think tank here in Washington. And Muid Yusuf, he's Associate Vice President of the Asia Center at the U.S. Institute of Peace, also here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Michael Kugelman, let me begin with you and sort of give us a situation report. As I said, both Mr. Trump in his inaugural address and in his address to the joint session of Congress didn't mention Afghanistan. And yet we are seeing, you know, a dire situation occurring. What are your thoughts with respect to where we are in Afghanistan?
Well, it's certainly true that Afghanistan is a mess, quite frankly. You really have a perfect storm of factors that involve the fact that the United States is not fighting a combat war anymore. There's a residual troop presence there of a bit over 8,400 troops that are essentially providing training and advice and assistance to Afghan forces, but they're not fighting alongside them in combat. The Afghan security forces have improved tremendously over the years, but they continue to struggle to push back against what has become a strengthening Taliban insurgency, to the point that, as was mentioned earlier, the Taliban actually controls a fair amount of the country. By no means anything closely approximating to a majority of the country, but it is a significant threat and it continues to grow. And when you combine this with the fact that you have other sources of militancy that are becoming very troublesome, like the fact that ISIL has now developed a profile in Afghanistan and has been claiming attacks, that's also something to worry about. And for me, what really makes this all so alarming is, as you suggested, no one is really talking about Afghanistan on high levels in this town. That really worries me. You simply don't hear about it as much as you should. And I would have hoped that when General Nicholson had been testifying on the Hill some weeks back, that there would have been some type of statement or some type of response, some type of acknowledgement from the White House that Afghanistan is very much on his mind and that a policy is being formulated. So I hope that'll change.
Turning to you, Muid Yusuf, are you equally concerned about the lack of conversation at the highest levels in the government with respect to Afghanistan?
Look, I mean, I think it doesn't send the right message, that's for sure, especially because the policy of the previous administration, the attempts to essentially end the war in Afghanistan, when that didn't work out, you know, there was also a sense in Afghanistan itself, in the region, quite frankly, that the U.S. may withdraw and leave prematurely. So it's crucial to send a signal of renewed American commitment, whether that's the additional troops that General Nicholson has asked for, or whether that is essentially having a conversation about Afghanistan Pakistan a policy review and making it clear that the U.S. is committed and giving a future course of action, I think it's crucial. Silence leaves people in limbo, leaves people wondering, and with the other sort of political dynamic in Washington that doesn't seem to be settling down, I can imagine either the allies who are fighting alongside the U.S. in Afghanistan or Afghans themselves or the region, Pakistan, for instance, you know, being very clear of where this is going or willing to stick their neck out to support the U.S. at this point.
Turning back to you, Michael Kugelman, to talk about why we appear to be regressing in Afghanistan, notwithstanding the fact that you said we have U.S. troops there who are training and providing advice. What are the factors, in your view, why the Taliban seems to be on the rise, ISIL is moving into vacuums?
There are all kinds of factors at play here. I think one problem is that the Afghan security forces have very specific incapacities that have really caused them to struggle. For instance, an inability to offer sufficient air cover to troops that are fighting under pressure, struggles gathering intelligence, things like that, that's really caused problems. And I think that, you know, the counterinsurgency process for Afghanistan has been a real struggle because Afghan forces have been in a position to take on and battle and kill Afghan forces. But the problem has been, you look at the notion of a clear hold and build strategy in counterinsurgency. The Afghan security forces have been able to do the easy work, which is to, you know, essentially take over land that's been seized by the Taliban, but then it's very difficult to essentially prevent the Taliban from coming back. So, you know, whatever momentum has been gained by defeating the Taliban or taking back territory that had been initially seized by the Taliban, it's been overcome by the fact that the Taliban is so resilient. So I think that's a major factor right there.
Mu'id Yusuf, where do you see the shortcomings with respect to the situation, why the Taliban seem to be gaining more territory, notwithstanding the improved security forces? Some talk about weak governance, there's so much corruption. I mean, how do you see it?
You know, when you start listing problems, there are so many. As Michael said, that I don't think is the issue here. The question, quite frankly, is, do we know how to do counterinsurgency? And even at that basic level, I would argue, the post-9/11 world, everybody struggled. And it's not only Afghanistan, but pretty much everywhere you look where you're fighting Islamist terrorists or militants, this problem is there. In Afghanistan, there is another slightly unique issue that you must look at, which is the regional dynamic. And every time you talk about Afghanistan, you've got to understand that victory in Afghanistan, however you define it, is going to be a function of a combination of internal progress and regional reconciliation. And I would argue that the region has never been less reconciled on the question of how to resolve the Afghanistan problem than today. Now, Russia and Iran are actively talking about ISIS, and there are reports that they're supporting the Taliban because they feel ISIS is the bigger threat. Pakistan, of course, has had its problems with Afghanistan, and the Afghanistan-Pakistan relationship is probably worse than it has been in recent history. And also, with the lack of clarity of U.S. policy, I think there's no real regional conversation that's coming together to figure out how the region will support Afghanistan's peace process, reconciliation, or the end game in the country.
Well, turning back to you, Michael Kugelman, to further discuss the points that Mu'id has made about the region, the regional reconciliation part of it, and the other players, to what extent are Iran and Russia playing a negative and undermining role? How do you see that?
Well, I think Mu'id hit on a very important point, that there is so much uncertainty in Afghanistan and the surrounding region about what the future U.S. role will be there. And so I think that we're starting to see these shifting dynamics where you have countries like Russia and Iran and China stepping up and wanting to play a much larger role in Afghanistan than they had been previously. And there are plenty of people in this town that believe that Russian efforts to reach out to the Taliban, as well as those of Iran, are not necessarily meant to be efforts to push back against the threat of ISIS, but more so simply to undercut the United States and to try to undercut U.S. influence. That certainly seemed to be the view of General Nicholson when he was testifying on Capitol Hill not that long ago. But look, this gets back to the critical issue, is that there needs to be a policy. In my view, President Trump needs to come out with some sort of statement laying out not just the troop level plan, but also what are the real true U.S. objectives in Afghanistan. Why are we there? Why do we continue to have 8,400 troops there? So I think that is the big thing. There needs to be some type of plan, and soon, from the White House.
Mu'ayyed Yusuf, do you see any signs of a plan coming from the Trump administration, who has been thus far rather silent on Afghanistan with respect to the new budget proposal? Is there any indication that they are going to take this war very seriously and try to deal with the threats?
I mean, I think sooner or later there is going to be a plan, because after all, there are U.S. troops in Afghanistan. President Trump has spoken to President Ghani as well, and the conversation about additional troops came up. I think it's a matter of time. The problem is perhaps prioritization, given everything that's happening on the domestic front. Also, remember that in the kind of situation we're in, sometimes you may have things happen without making much noise about them. I mean, there's so much noise on other things that it may just be lost in that, but there may be a review that is happening or comes about and very quickly makes a decision on where to go. The silence, as I said, is not helpful, but I cannot imagine there being no policy on Afghanistan in the coming months from the White House. I mean, it has to happen one way or another.
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. Joining us are Michael Kugelman, he's Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center, a think tank here in Washington, and Mu'ayyed Yusuf, from whom you just heard. He's Associate Vice President of the Asia Center at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And we are talking about the status of the war in Afghanistan, the longest-running war in U.S. history, and what the Trump administration plans to do to stabilize the situation. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Now here's a shout out to John Nestor Milimunu. He's a fan from Conakry, Guinea. Well, back to you, Michael Kugelman. Let's talk about the governance piece, which is often characterized as rather weak. There's a lot of corruption. Talk about President Ashraf Ghani's role as president and that of his government. To what extent the weak government play a role in perpetuating or somehow exacerbating the current stalemate?
Well, it plays a huge role. Keeping in mind that the government in Afghanistan is a national unity government. It is comprised of two leaders, Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah Abdullah, and it was the result of a negotiation that came out of an election stalemate in 2014. So as a result, you have two leaders that in many ways don't get along. There are a lot of rivalries. There have been tensions that have spilled out into the open. And as a result, there simply have been major problems with carrying out very basic tasks, from providing basic services to appointing cabinet ministers. And so fighting a very strong insurgency is that much harder. And certainly, one could argue that President Ghani personally has taken a major responsibility to try to deal with the corruption problem in Afghanistan. But he's one leader. He's one strong leader, but he's just one person. Given the structural levels of corruption in Afghanistan, it's not going to be easy to deal with. And unfortunately, the fact that governance is so weak and the fact that corruption is so high really works to the advantage of the Taliban. Because the Taliban could essentially say to people in Afghanistan, well, look, you know, you have an illegitimate government that came to be through a U.S.-led negotiation. It can't get things done. It's corrupt. Look at us. We're much more credible.
Mu'ayyed Yusuf, do you think that the corrupt governance, or what was perceived as weak governance, does have a bearing on the insurgency and the ability for Taliban to exploit that?
I mean, I think there's no question. And if you talk to Afghanistan experts or people on the ground, not only in Afghanistan, I would argue in most cases where these kind of insurgencies are taking place, what you'll find is that governance is one major part of the grievances of the population. I mean, majority of Afghans are not with the Taliban. But quite frankly, in most insurgency contexts, majority is not with the insurgent. It is just that they have enough either support or intimidation power to get people to back what they're doing. And in Afghanistan, remember, there's a history. Only in the 90s, the Taliban were there. I mean, the streets of Afghanistan were cheering when they were kicked out. And now you have a mixed sort of review out of that, because a lot of people would argue that things are not moving in the direction that they should have in terms of governance. And even though there's been tremendous progress, I think we shouldn't overlook the amount of progress in Afghanistan, especially in the cities. The fact of the matter is the Taliban are very much there. They have backers inside and outside Afghanistan, and the security situation has deteriorated.
Talking about backers inside and outside of Afghanistan, Michael Kugelman, that brings us to Pakistan, the Haqqani Network. Remind us of who they are and what influence they have in helping to, again, fuel this insurgency?
The fact of the matter is that the top leadership of those leading the insurgency in Afghanistan have sanctuary in Pakistan. The Afghan Taliban leadership and its allies, the Haqqani Network, which is a militant group, particularly ferocious, very closely aligned with the Taliban, has carried out a number of spectacular attacks in Afghanistan, including in Kabul. These groups have sanctuaries in Pakistan, and I think that's a bottom line factor that obviously ensures tensions in U.S.-Pakistan relations. You know, the bottom line is that so long as an insurgency enjoys sanctuary, particularly over the border, the insurgency is going to remain strong. So I think certainly, you know, if we want to talk about the causes of the insurgency and the reasons why it's so strong in Afghanistan, you could talk about the governance problems in Afghanistan. You could talk about the troubled government. And you could talk about the beleaguered Afghan forces that are not in a position to push back against the Taliban. But again, at the end of the day, the sanctuary issue looms very large here. And I think that it was very significant that the Obama administration, relatively late in its term, decided to take matters into its own hands, so to speak, and it decided to launch a drone strike in Balochistan, in Pakistan, where the supreme leader of the Taliban, Mullah Mansoor, was, and they killed him.
Let me turn now to Mu'ayyad Yusuf to comment on that, to continue this conversation about the factor of sanctuaries in Pakistan, the Haqqani Network allied with the Taliban, to what extent that is a very important factor in perpetuating this insurgency.
Look, I think there's no question that one of the biggest problems between the U.S. and Pakistan when it comes to Afghanistan is this sanctuary problem. I mean, it's been talked about ad nauseum, you know, the communication on this continues. The problem, of course, is that Pakistan and U.S. interests diverge on this issue. And a lot has been made out of why Pakistan is not sort of going after these groups, etc. And I keep arguing that it's a very fundamental divergence of interest on how both sides want to solve the Afghanistan problem. We've sort of talked about in the US over and over again about the need for Pakistan to do this because it's the right thing. The Taliban are disrupting peace in Afghanistan, etc. Pakistan's view of the region flows through India. And for the longest period, Pakistan looks at India before it decides what it wants to do. There's a history attached to this. Pakistan sees India sort of, you know, having influence in Afghanistan, exaggerates that sort of conversation. I think the tools being used to solve this U.S.-Pakistan disconnect are disconnected themselves. The U.S. has tried to get Pakistan to go after the sanctuaries with every single tool we have in the toolkit, except looking at Pakistan's problem, which is the India-Pakistan issue. Now, Pakistan argues that unless something is done on that account, we'll do certain things, but we're not going to do too much of that. And then there are a number of other issues. So the bottom line here is I don't see this as a side cheating the other or, you know, one side being better off than the other by following a certain policy or not. The fact is very clear divergence of interest. Both sides see the Afghan solution in a very different way, even though both want Afghanistan to settle down. And unless we resolve that issue in a very candid manner, I think we're just going to keep talking past each other.
Turning back to you, Michael Kugelman, to take up this India-Pakistan issue that Mu'ayyad Yusuf brought up, does the United States, do other international actors understand how important this is for Pakistan and that that is an impediment? The fact that they see, perhaps in an exaggerated way, too much Indian influence in Afghanistan, and that is what sort of keeps them from being more cooperative. If you see that as the case, what can we do to thread the needle here in some way, mollify Pakistan and get them to cooperate?
Well, it's a tough question to answer. And quite frankly, I think that the U.S., certainly the Obama administration and also the Trump administration, really values its relationship with New Delhi and wants to be very careful how it approaches the India-Pakistan relationship, simply because New Delhi fears that any effort by an outside mediator to try to get India and Pakistan to work through their problems will invariably mean opening the Kashmir can of worms, so to speak. And India, of course, believes that the matter of this disputed region is settled, doesn't want to talk about it. So I think that the U.S. may be very cautious about how it approaches the India-Pakistan conflict. But certainly, I do think that Washington tends to underappreciate Pakistan's very real concerns about a number of issues related to terrorism in the broader region, one being that most of the terrorist attacks that have taken place inside Pakistan over the last few months have been staged by groups that are based not in Pakistan, but in Afghanistan. And Pakistan has often said, well, why doesn't the U.S., working with the Afghans, do more to go after these groups that are inside Afghanistan? It's ironic because, of course, this is the same argument that the U.S. and Afghanistan make about how you have terrorists based in Pakistan that stage attacks in Afghanistan. So I think that for the U.S., it's not an easy issue to deal with, particularly because, you know, the U.S. is not fighting a war in Afghanistan anymore. The Afghans have their own hands full dealing with the Taliban insurgency it's facing there. But I do think it would be useful if U.S. officials were to take a more broad-minded approach to this issue of militancy and taking into account these very real concerns that Pakistan has.
And quickly, Mujib Yusuf, how do you think Washington should deal with Pakistan on this issue so that they can be more cooperative in Afghanistan? What could they do vis-a-vis Pakistan? And Pakistan also has to make an effort and have compromise.
I think we've really got to think outside the box here. You know, the two or three things I would say is, first of all, we've got to link somehow whatever the ask on Afghanistan is with some carrots on the India-Pakistan issue. I agree with Michael, it's very difficult to figure out what that may be. But what we have seen in the past 15 years is that unless we create a link, unless we take a broader sort of approach to this, we haven't managed to get what we need out of the sanctuary issue. So that's one. Second, I think we also need to be clear that the end goal and game in Afghanistan, even if more troops go in, has to be a reconciliation process in which the Taliban are brought into the system somehow. I think nobody in their right mind can talk about a outright military victory at this point. If that's true, the quicker we put out a reconciliation, a blueprint, if you will, a game plan for how to do reconciliation and what role regional players will have in that, the easier it will become to then have a conversation to say, this is what we want done, or this is where we leave you out if you don't do X. As we started off, you know, when there is so much uncertainty in the air, what do you do as a rational actor? The first thing you do is hedge your bets. And the more regional countries, including Pakistan, feel the need to hedge, the less likely it is that they are going to fully cooperate with whatever the U.S. asks are. So I think that's the start in some ways. But I've been convinced for a long time that we've pretty much exhausted all tools available with Pakistan, apart from this regional dynamic with the India-Pakistan issue. And the other tools simply have not worked, and I've never really thought they had a serious chance of working either.
All right. Quickly, before we close, a very quick question to both of you on economics with respect to battling narcotics in Afghanistan. To what extent do you see opium production, which is now at an all-time high, which certainly has to play a role in fueling the insurgency, perhaps financing it? What can we do? Why have the billions of dollars spent to battle narcotics in Afghanistan resulted in a stalemate or perhaps a worsening of the situation?
I think this has been one of the most challenging policies for the U.S. in Afghanistan. It's tried everything to deal with the drug problem there. It's tried to spray the crops, which hasn't worked. It's tried to generate alternative livelihood programs for poppy farmers. Unfortunately, nothing seems to work. And as you suggest, this helps fuel the insurgency. And as a result, you have surrounding countries, Pakistan, Russia, Iran, that have horrible heroin epidemics, and much of these drugs come from Afghanistan. It certainly is something that continues to require our attention.
And the last word to you, Mujib Yusuf, on this narcotics problem.
Michael's put it rightly. It's an issue that they've tried various policies on this, and it doesn't seem to work at the end of the day. What we now know, and we didn't some years ago, is that there's clear evidence and data to suggest that the insurgency does sustain itself partly on money that it generates, revenue that it generates from narcotics. And, you know, narcotics then spreads into the bordering countries, but also elsewhere. If you look at the Russian issue, one of the big concerns that Russia's had is narcotics travel up north. And that's one of the reasons why they do not want to lose the north of Afghanistan to an ISIS kind of presence, because they feel that it's not only radicalization, but other mechanisms to get to Russia and harm Russia are going to be more potent if that happens. So there's a whole slew of issues here attached to this. But I would be very sort of candid in saying that I think in some ways it's a bit too late to see the narcotics issue being controlled in a way that it would really affect the insurgency positively from the U.S. perspective. I think various things have been tried, but unfortunately it still remains one of the key avenues to generate revenue for the Taliban and the insurgency.
That is all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Michael Kugelman, he's Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center, and Muid Yusuf, he's Associate Vice President of the Asia Center at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your terrific insights. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Rashad Smith. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.